The Ego and His Own by Max Stirner, continued, cassette 3, side 2. Formerly, the Pope gave consecration and his blessing to it and its princes. Now, the state is intrinsically sacred. Majesty is sacred without needing the priest's blessing. The order of nature, or natural law, was altogether hallowed as God's ordinance. Hence it is said in the Augsburg Confession, Article 2, "So now we reasonably abide by the saying, as the jurisconsults have wisely and rightly said, that man and woman should be with each other as a natural law. Now if it is a natural law, then it is God's ordinance, therefore implanted in nature, and therefore a divine law also." And is it anything more than Protestantism brought up to date, when Feuerbach pronounces moral relations sacred? Not as God's ordinance, indeed, but instead for the sake of the spirit that dwells in them? But marriage, as a free alliance of love, of course, is sacred of itself by the nature of the union that is formed here. That marriage alone is a religious one that is a true one that corresponds to the essence of marriage, love. And so it is with all moral relations. They are ethical, are cultivated with a moral mind only where they rank as religious of themselves. True friendship is only where the limits of friendship are preserved with religious conscientiousness, with the same conscientiousness with which the believer guards the dignity of his God. Friendship is and must be sacred for you, and property, and marriage, and the good of every man, but sacred in and of itself. That is a very essential consideration. In Catholicism, the mundane can indeed be consecrated or hallowed, but it is not sacred without this priestly blessing. In Protestantism, on the contrary, mundane relations are sacred of themselves, sacred by their mere existence. The Jesuit maxim, "the end hallows the means," corresponds precisely to the consecration by which sanctity is bestowed. No means are holy or unholy in themselves, but their relation to the Church, their use for the Church, hallows the means. Regicide was named as such. If it was committed for the Church's behoof, it would be certain of being hallowed by the Church, even if the hallowing was not openly pronounced. To the Protestant, majesty ranks as sacred. To the Catholic, only that majesty which is consecrated by the pontiff can rank as such. And it does rank as such to him only because the Pope, even though it be without a special act, confers this sacredness on it once for all. If he retracted his consecration, the king would be left only a man of the world, or layman, an unconsecrated man, to the Catholic. If the Protestant seeks to discover a sacredness in the sensual itself, that he may then be linked only to what is holy, the Catholic strives rather to banish the sensual from himself into a separate domain, where it, like the rest of nature, keeps its value for itself. The Catholic Church eliminated mundane marriage from its consecrated order, and withdrew those who were its own from the mundane family. The Protestant Church declared marriage and family ties to be holy, and therefore not unsuitable for its clergymen. A Jesuit may, as a good Catholic, hallow everything. He needs only, for example, to say to himself, "I, as a priest, am necessary to the Church, but serve it more zealously when I appease my desires properly. Consequently, I will seduce this girl, have my enemy there poisoned, etc. My end is holy because it is a priest's. Consequently, it hallows the means. For in the end, it is still done for the benefit of the Church. Why should the Catholic priest shrink from handing Emperor Henry VII the poisoned wafer for the Church's welfare?" The genuinely churchly Protestants invade against every innocent pleasure, because only the sacred, the spiritual, could be innocent. What they could not point out the Holy Spirit in, the Protestants had to reject: dancing, the theater, ostentation in the church, and the like. Compared with this puritanical Calvinism, Lutheranism is again more on the religious, spiritual track, is more radical. For the former excludes at once a great number of things as sensual and worldly, and purifies the Church. Lutheranism, on the contrary, tries to bring spirit into all things as far as possible, to recognize the Holy Spirit as an essence in everything, and so to hallow everything worldly. No one can forbid a kiss in honor. The spirit of honor hallows it. Hence it was that the Lutheran Hegel, he declares himself such in some passage or other, he wants to remain a Lutheran, was completely successful in carrying the idea through everything. In everything there is reason, Holy Spirit, or the real is rational. For the real is in fact everything. As in each thing, for instance, each lie, the truth can be detected. There is no absolute lie, no absolute evil, and the like. Great works of mind were created almost solely by Protestants, as they alone were the true disciples and consummators of mind. How little man is able to control! He must let the sun run its course, the sea roll its waves, the mountains rise to heaven. Thus he stands powerless before the uncontrollable. Can he keep off the impression that he is helpless against this gigantic world? It is a fixed law to which he must submit. It determines his fate. Now, what did pre-Christian humanity work toward? Toward getting rid of the eruptions of the destinies, not letting oneself be vexed by them. The Stoics attained this in apathy, declaring the attacks of nature indifferent and not letting themselves be affected by them. Horace utters the famous nil admirari, by which he likewise announces the indifference of the other, the world. It is not to influence us, not to rouse our astonishment. And that impavidum feriant ruinae expresses the very same imperturbability as Psalm 46, verse 3. We do not fear, though the earth should perish. In all this, there is room made for the Christian proposition that the world is empty, for the Christian contempt of the world. The imperturbable spirit of the wise man, with which the old world worked to prepare its end, now underwent an inner perturbation against which no ataraxia, no Stoic courage, was able to protect it. The spirit, secured against all influence of the world, insensible to its shocks and exalted above its attacks, admiring nothing, not to be disconcerted by any downfall of the world, foamed over irrepressibly again, because gases, spirits, were evolved in its own interior, and after the mechanical shock that comes from without had become ineffective, chemical tensions that agitate within began their wonderful play. In fact, ancient history ends with this, that I have struggled till I won my ownership of the world. All things have been delivered to me by my Father, Matthew 11:27. It has ceased to be overpowering, unapproachable, sacred, divine for me. It is undeified, and now I treat it so entirely as I please that, if I cared, I could exert on it all miracle-working power, that is, power of mind, remove mountains, command mulberry trees to tear themselves up and transplant themselves into the sea, Luke 17:6, and do everything possible, thinkable. All things are possible to him who believes. I am the Lord of the world. Mine is the glory. The world has become prosaic, for the divine has vanished from it. It is my property, which I dispose of as I, to wit, the mind, choose. When I had exalted myself to be the owner of the world, egoism had won its first complete victory, had vanquished the world, had become worldless, and put the acquisitions of a long age under lock and key. The first property, the first glory, has been acquired. But the Lord of the world is not yet Lord of his thoughts, his feelings, his will. He is not Lord and owner of the Spirit, for the Spirit is still sacred. The Holy Spirit and the worldless Christian is not able to become godless. If the ancient struggle was a struggle against the world, the medieval Christian struggle is a struggle against self, the mind. The former against the outer world, the latter against the inner world. The medieval man is the man whose gaze is turned inward, the thinking, meditative man. All wisdom of the ancients is the science of the world. All wisdom of the moderns is the science of God. The heathen, Jews included, got through with the world, but now the thing was to get through with self, the spirit, too, to become spiritless or godless. For almost 2,000 years we have been working at subjecting the Holy Spirit to ourselves, and little by little we have torn off and trodden underfoot many bits of sacredness. But the gigantic opponent is constantly rising anew under a changed form and name. The Spirit has not yet lost its divinity, its holiness, its sacredness. To be sure, it has long ceased to flutter over our heads as a dove. To be sure, it no longer gladdens its saints alone, but lets itself be caught by the laity too. But as spirit of humanity, as spirit of man with a capital M, it remains still an alien spirit to me or you, still far from becoming our unrestricted property, which we dispose of at our pleasure. However, one thing certainly happened, and visibly guided the progress of post-Christian history. This one thing was the endeavor to make the Holy Spirit more human and bring it nearer to men, or men to it. Through this, it came about that at last it could be conceived as the Spirit of humanity, and under different expressions like idea of humanity, mankind, humaneness, general philanthropy, appeared more attractive, more familiar, and more accessible. Would not one think that now everybody could possess the Holy Spirit, take up into himself the idea of humanity, bring mankind to form and existence in himself? No. The Spirit is not stripped of its holiness and robbed of its unapproachableness, is not accessible to us, not our property. For the Spirit of humanity is not my Spirit. My ideal it may be, and as a thought I call it mine. The thought of humanity is my property, and I prove this sufficiently by propounding it quite according to my views, and shaping it today so, tomorrow otherwise. We represent it to ourselves in the most manifold ways, but it is at the same time an entail which I cannot alienate nor get rid of. Among many transformations, the Holy Spirit became in time the absolute idea, which again, in manifold refractions, split into the different ideas of philanthropy, reasonableness, civic virtue, and so on. But can I call the idea my property if it is the idea of humanity? And can I consider the Spirit as vanquished if I am to serve it, sacrifice myself to it? Antiquity, at its close, had gained its ownership of the world only when it had broken the world's overpoweringness and divinity, recognized the world's powerlessness and vanity. The case with regard to the Spirit corresponds. When I have degraded it to a spook and its control over me to a cranky notion, then it is to be looked upon as having lost its sacredness, its holiness, its divinity, and then I use it, as one uses nature, at pleasure, without scruple. The nature of the case, the concept of the relationship, is to guide me in dealing with the case or in contracting the relation. As if a concept of the case existed on its own account, and was not rather the concept that one forms of the case. As if a relation which we enter into was not, by the uniqueness of those who enter into it, itself unique. As if it depended on how others stamp it. But as people separated the essence of man from the real man, and judged the latter by the former, so they also separate his action from him, and appraise it by human value. Concepts are to decide everywhere, concepts to regulate life, concepts to rule. This is the religious world, to which Hegel gave a systematic expression, bringing method into the nonsense, and completing the conceptual precepts into a rounded, firmly based dogmatic. Everything is sung according to concepts, and the real man, I, am compelled to live according to these conceptual laws. Can there be a more grievous dominion of law, and did not Christianity confess at the very beginning that it meant only to draw Judaism's dominion of law tighter? Not a letter of the law shall be lost. Liberalism simply brought other concepts on the carpet, human instead of divine, political instead of ecclesiastical, scientific instead of doctrinal, or, more generally, real concepts and eternal laws instead of crude dogmas and precepts. Now, nothing but mind rules in the world. An innumerable multitude of concepts buzz about in people's heads. And what are those doing who endeavor to get further? They are negating these concepts to put new ones in their place. They are saying, you form a false concept of right, of the state, of man, of liberty, of truth, of marriage. The concept of right, etc., is rather that one which we now set up. Thus, the confusion of concepts moves forward. The history of the world has dealt cruelly with us, and the Spirit has obtained an almighty power. You must have regard for my miserable shoes, which could protect your naked foot, my salt, by which your potatoes would become palatable, and my state carriage, whose possession would relieve you of all need at once. You must not reach out after them. Man is to recognize the independence of all these and innumerable other things. They are to rank in his mind as something that cannot be seized or approached, are to be kept away from him. He must have regard for it, respect it. Woe to him if he stretches out his fingers desirously. We call that being light-fingered. How beggarly little is left us. Yes, how really nothing. Everything has been removed. We must not venture on anything unless it is given us. We continue to live only by the grace of the giver. You must not pick up a pin, unless, indeed, you have got leave to do so. And got it from whom? From respect. Only when this lets you have it as property, only when you can respect it as property, only then may you take it. And again, you are not to conceive a thought, speak a syllable, commit an action, that should have their warrant in you alone, instead of receiving it from morality, or reason, or humanity. Happy unconstraint of the desirous man, how mercilessly people have tried to slay you on the altar of constraint. But around the altar rise the arches of a church, and its walls keep moving further and further out. What they enclose is sacred. You can no longer get to it, no longer touch it. Shrieking with the hunger that devours you, you wander round about these walls in search of the little that is profane, and the circles of your course keep growing more and more extended. Soon that church will embrace the whole world, and you be driven out to the extreme edge, another step, and the world of the sacred has conquered. You sink into the abyss. Therefore take courage while it is yet time. Wander about no longer in the profane, where now it is dry feeding. Dare the leap and rush in through the gates into the sanctuary itself. If you devour the sacred, you have made it your own. Digest the sacramental wafer, and you are rid of it. C. The Free. The ancients and the moderns having been presented above in two divisions, it may seem as if the free were here to be described in a third division, as independent and distinct. This is not so. The free are only the more modern and most modern among the moderns, and are put in a separate division merely because they belong to the present, and what is present, above all, claims our attention here. I give the free only as a translation of the liberals, but must, with regard to the concept of freedom, as in general with regard to so many other things whose anticipatory introduction cannot be avoided, refer to what comes later. 1. Political liberalism. After the chalice of so-called absolute monarchy had been drained down to the dregs, in the 18th century people became aware that their drink did not taste human, too clearly aware not to begin to crave a different cup. Since our fathers were human beings, after all, they at last desired also to be regarded as such. Whoever sees in us something else than human beings, in him we likewise will not see a human being, but an inhuman being, and will meet him as an unhuman being. On the other hand, whoever recognizes us as human beings, and protects us against the danger of being treated inhumanly, him we will honor as our true protector and guardian. Let us then hold together and protect the man in each other. Then we find the necessary protection in our holding together, and in ourselves, those who hold together, a fellowship of those who know their human dignity and hold together as human beings. Our holding together is the state. We who hold together are the nation. In our being together as nation or state, we are only human beings. How we deport ourselves in other respects as individuals, and what self-seeking impulses we may there succumb to, belong solely to our private life. Our public or state life is a purely human one. Everything unhuman or egoistic that clings to us is degraded to a private matter, and we distinguish the state definitely from civil society, which is the sphere of egoism's activity. The true man is the nation, but the individual is always an egoist. Therefore, strip off your individuality or isolation, wherein dwells discord and egoistic inequality, and consecrate yourselves wholly to the true man, the nation, or the state. Then you will rank as men, and have all that is man's. The state, the true man, will entitle you to what belongs to it, and give you the rights of man. Man gives you his rights. So runs the speech of the commonalty. The commonalty is nothing else than the thought that the state is all in all, the true man, and that the individual's human value consists in being a citizen of the state. In being a good citizen, he seeks his highest honor. Beyond that, he knows nothing higher than at most the antiquated being a good Christian. The commonalty developed itself in the struggle against the privileged classes, by whom it was cavalierly treated as third estate and confounded with the canaille. In other words, up to this time the state had recognized caste. The son of a nobleman was selected for posts to which the most distinguished commoners aspired in vain. The civic feeling revolted against this. No more distinction, no giving preference to persons, no difference of classes. Let all be alike. No separate interest is to be pursued longer, but the general interest of all. The state is to be a fellowship of free and equal men, and everyone is to devote himself to the welfare of the whole, to be dissolved in the state, to make the state his end and ideal. State! State! So ran the general cry, and thenceforth people sought for the right form of state, the best constitution, and so the state in its best conception. The thought of the state passed into all hearts and awakened enthusiasm. To serve it, this mundane god, became the new divine service and worship. The properly political epoch had dawned. To serve the state or the nation became the highest ideal, the state's interest the highest interest, state service, for which one does not by any means need to be an official, the highest honor. So then, the separate interests and personalities had been scared away, and sacrifice for the state had become the shibboleth. One must give up himself and live only for the state. One must act disinterestedly, not want to benefit himself, but the state. Hereby the latter has become the true person, before whom the individual personality vanishes. Not I live, but it lives in me. Therefore, in comparison with the former self-seeking, this was unselfishness and impersonality itself. Before this god, state, all egoism vanished, and before it all were equal. They were without any other distinction, men, nothing but men. The revolution took fire from the inflammable material of property. The government needed money. Now it must prove the proposition that it is absolute, and so master of all property, sole proprietor. It must take to itself its money, which was only in the possession of the subjects, not their property. Instead of this, it calls States General to have this money granted to it. The shrinking from strictly logical action destroyed the illusion of an absolute government. He who must have something granted to him cannot be regarded as absolute. The subjects recognized that they were real proprietors, and that it was their money that was demanded. Those who had hitherto been subjects attained the consciousness that they were proprietors. Bailly depicts this in a few words. If you cannot dispose of my property without my assent, how much less can you of my person, of all that concerns my mental and social position? All this is my property, like the piece of land that I till, and I have a right, an interest, to make the laws myself. Bailly's words sound certainly as if everyone was a proprietor now. However, instead of the government, instead of the prince, the nation now became proprietor and master. From this time on, the ideal is spoken of as popular liberty, a free people, etc. As early as July 8, 1789, the declaration of the Bishop of Autun and Barrère took away all semblance of the importance of each and every individual in legislation. It showed the complete powerlessness of the constituents. The majority of the representatives has become master. When, on July 9th, the plan for division of the work on the Constitution is proposed, Mirabeau remarks that the government has only power, no rights. Only in the people is the source of all right to be found. On July 16th, this same Mirabeau exclaims, "Is not the people the source of all power? The source, therefore, of all right, and the source of all power." By the way, here the substance of right becomes visible. It is power. He who has power has right. The commonalty is the heir of the privileged classes. In fact, the rights of the barons, which were taken from them as usurpations, only passed over to the commonalty. For the commonalty was now called the nation. Into the hands of the nation all prerogatives were given back. Thereby they ceased to be prerogatives, they became rights. From this time on, the nation demands tithes, compulsory services. It has inherited the Lord's Court, the rights of vert and venison, the serfs. The night of August 4th was the death night of privileges or prerogatives. Cities, communes, boards of magistrates were also privileged, furnished with prerogatives and seigneurial rights. and ended with the new morning of Right, the Rights of the State, the Rights of the Nation. The monarch in the person of the royal master had been a paltry monarch compared with this new monarch, the sovereign nation. This monarchy was 1,000 times severer, stricter, and more consistent. Against the new monarch, there was no longer any right, any privilege at all. How limited the absolute king of the Ancien Régime looks in comparison. The revolution effected the transformation of limited monarchy into absolute monarchy. From this time on, every right that is not conferred by this monarch is an assumption, but every prerogative that he bestows, a right. The times demanded absolute royalty, absolute monarchy. Therefore, down fell that so-called absolute royalty which had so little understood how to become absolute that it remained limited by 1,000 little lords. What was longed for and striven for through thousands of years, to wit, to find that absolute lord beside whom no other lords and lordlings any longer exist to clip his power, the bourgeoisie has brought to pass. It has revealed the lord who alone confers rightful titles, and without whose warrant nothing is justified. So now we know that an idol is nothing in the world, and that there is no other god save the one. Against right, one can no longer, as against a right, come forward with the assertion that it is a wrong. One can say now only that it is a piece of nonsense, an illusion. If one called it wrong, one would have to set up another right in opposition to it, and measure it by this. If, on the contrary, one rejects right as such, right in and of itself, altogether, then one also rejects the concept of wrong, and dissolves the whole concept of right, to which the concept of wrong belongs. What is the meaning of the doctrine that we all enjoy equality of political rights? Only this, that the state has no regard for my person, that to it I, like every other, am only a man, without having another significance that commands its deference. I do not command its deference as an aristocrat, a nobleman's son, or even as heir of an official whose office belongs to me by inheritance, as in the Middle Ages, countships, etc., and later under absolute royalty where hereditary offices occur. Now the state has an innumerable multitude of rights to give away, the right to lead a battalion, a company, etc., the right to lecture at a university, and so forth. It has them to give away because they are its own, namely, state rights, or political rights. Withal, it makes no difference to it to whom it gives them, if the receiver only fulfills the duties that spring from the delegated rights. To it, we are all of us all right and equal, one worth no more and no less than another. It is indifferent to me who receives the command of the army, says the sovereign state, provided the grantee understands the matter properly. Equality of political rights has, consequently, the meaning that everyone may acquire every right that the state has to give away, if only he fulfills the conditions annexed thereto, conditions which are to be sought only in the nature of the particular right, not in a predilection for the person, persona grata. The nature of the right to become an officer brings with it the necessity that one possess sound limbs and a suitable measure of knowledge, but it does not have noble birth as a condition. If, on the other hand, even the most deserving commoner could not reach that station, then an inequality of political rights would exist. Among the states of today, one has carried out that maxim of equality more, another less. The monarchy of estates, so I will call absolute royalty, the time of the kings before the revolution, kept the individual independence on a lot of little monarchies. These were fellowships, societies, like the guilds, the nobility, the priesthood, the burgher class, cities, communes. Everywhere the individual must regard himself first as a member of this little society and yield unconditional obedience to its spirit, the esprit de corps, as his monarch. More than the individual nobleman himself must his family, the honor of his race, be to him. Only by means of his corporation, his estate, did the individual have relation to the greater corporation, the state. As in Catholicism, the individual deals with God only through the priest. To this, the third estate now, showing courage to negate itself as an estate, made an end. It decided no longer to be and be called an estate beside other estates, but to glorify and generalize itself into the nation. Hereby, it created a much more complete and absolute monarchy, and the entire previously ruling principle of estates, the principle of little monarchies inside the great, went down. Therefore, it cannot be said that the revolution was a revolution against the first two privileged estates. It was against the little monarchies of estates in general. But if the estates and their despotism were broken, the king, too, we know, was only a king of estates, not a citizen king, the individuals freed from the inequality of estate were left. Were they now really to be without estate and out of gear, no longer bound by any estate, without a general bond of union? No, for the third estate had declared itself the nation only in order not to remain an estate beside other estates, but to become the sole estate. This sole estate is the nation, the state. What had the individual now become? A political Protestant, for he had come into immediate connection with his God, the state. He was no longer, as an aristocrat, in the monarchy of the nobility, as a mechanic in the monarchy of the guild, but he, like all, recognized and acknowledged only one lord, the state, as whose servants they all received the equal title of honor, citizen. The bourgeoisie is the aristocracy of desert. Its motto, let desert wear its crowns. It fought against the lazy aristocracy, for, according to it, the industrious aristocracy acquired by industry and desert, it is not the born who is free, nor yet I who am free either, but the deserving man, the honest servant of his king, of the state, of the people in constitutional states. Through service, one acquires freedom, that is, acquires deserts, even if one served mammon. One must deserve well of the state, of the principle of the state, of its moral spirit. He who serves this spirit of the state is a good citizen. Let him live to whatever honest branch of industry he will. In its eyes, innovators practice a breadless art. Only the shopkeeper is practical, and the spirit that chases after public offices is as much the shopkeeping spirit as is that which tries in trade to feather its nest or otherwise to become useful to itself and anybody else. But if the deserving count as the free, for what does the comfortable commoner, the faithful office holder, lack of that freedom that his heart desires, then the servants are the free. The obedient servant is the free man. What glaring nonsense! Yet this is the sense of the bourgeoisie, and its poet, Goethe, as well as its philosopher, Hegel, succeeded in glorifying the dependence of the subject on the object, obedience to the objective world. He who only serves the cause, devotes himself entirely to it, has the true freedom. And among thinkers the cause was reason, that which, like state and church, gives general laws and puts the individual man in irons by the thought of humanity. It determines what is true, according to which one must then act. No more rational people than the honest servants, who primarily are called good citizens as servants of the state. Be rich as Croesus or poor as Job, the state of the commonalty leaves that to your option, but only have a good disposition. This it demands of you, and counts it its most urgent task to establish this in all. Therefore, it will keep you from evil promptings, holding the ill-disposed in check, and silencing their inflammatory discourses under censors' canceling marks or press penalties and behind dungeon walls, and will, on the other hand, appoint people of good disposition as censors, and in every way have a moral influence exerted on you by well-disposed and well-meaning people. If it has made you deaf to evil promptings, then it opens your ears again all the more diligently to good promptings. With the time of the bourgeoisie begins that of liberalism. People want to see what is rational, suited to the times, etc., established everywhere. The following definition of liberalism, which is supposed to be pronounced in its honor, characterizes it completely. Liberalism is nothing else than the knowledge of reason applied to our existing relations. Its aim is a rational order, a moral behavior, a limited freedom, not anarchy, lawlessness, selfhood. But if reason rules, then the person succumbs. Art has, for a long time, not only acknowledged the ugly, but considered the ugly as necessary to its existence, and takes it up into itself. It needs the villain. In the religious domain, too, the extremist liberals go so far that they want to see the most religious man regarded as a citizen, that is, the religious villain. They want to see no more of trials for heresy. But against the rational law, no one is to rebel. Otherwise, he is threatened with the severest penalty. What is wanted is not free movement and realization of the person or of me, but of reason, a dominion of reason, a dominion. The liberals are zealots, not exactly for the faith, for God, but certainly for reason, their master. They brook no lack of breeding, and therefore no self-development and self-determination. They play the guardian as effectively as the most absolute rulers. Political liberty. What are we to understand by that? Perhaps the individual's independence of the state and its laws? No. On the contrary, the individual's subjection in the state and to the state's laws. But why liberty? Because one is no longer separated from the state by intermediaries, but stands in direct and immediate relation to it. Because one is a citizen, not the subject of another, not even of the king as a person, but only in his quality as supreme head of the state. Political liberty, this fundamental doctrine of liberalism, is nothing but a second phase of Protestantism, and runs quite parallel with religious liberty. Or would it perhaps be right to understand by the latter an independence of religion? Anything but that. Independence of intermediaries is all that it is intended to express. Independence of mediating priests, the abolition of the laity, and so direct and immediate relation to religion or to God. Only on the supposition that one has religion can he enjoy freedom of religion. Freedom of religion does not mean being without religion, but inwardness of faith, unmediated intercourse with God. To him who is religiously free, religion is an affair of the heart. It is to him his own affair. It is to him a sacredly serious matter. So, too, to the politically free man, the state is a sacredly serious matter. It is his heart's affair, his chief affair, his own affair. Political liberty means that the polis, the state, is free. Freedom of religion, that religion is free, as freedom of conscience signifies that conscience is free. Not, therefore, that I am free from the state, from religion, from conscience, or that I am rid of them. It does not mean my liberty, but the liberty of a power that rules and subjugates me. It means that one of my despots, like state, religion, conscience, is free. State, religion, conscience, these despots make me a slave, and their liberty is my slavery. That in this they necessarily follow the principle, the end hallows the means, is self-evident. If the welfare of the state is the end, war is a hallowed means. If justice is the state's end, homicide is a hallowed means, and is called by its sacred name, execution. The sacred state hallows everything that is serviceable to it. Individual liberty, over which civic liberalism keeps jealous watch, does not by any means signify a completely free self-determination, by which actions become altogether mine, but only independence of persons. Individually free is he who is responsible to no man. Taken in this sense, and we are not allowed to understand it otherwise, not only the ruler is individually free, irresponsible toward men, before God we know he acknowledges himself responsible, but all who are responsible only to the law. This kind of liberty was won through the revolutionary movement of the century, to wit, independence of arbitrary will, or telle notre plaisir. Hence the constitutional prince must himself be stripped of all personality, deprived of all individual decision, that he may not as a person, as an individual man, violate the individual liberty of others. The personal will of the ruler has disappeared in the constitutional prince. It is with a right feeling, therefore, that absolute princes resist this. Nevertheless, these very ones profess to be, in the best sense, Christian princes. For this, however, they must become a purely spiritual power, as the Christian is subject only to spirit. God is spirit. The purely spiritual power is consistently represented only by the constitutional prince, he who, without any personal significance, stands there spiritualized to the degree that he can rank as a sheer, uncanny spirit, as an idea. The constitutional king is the truly Christian king, the genuine, consistent carrying out of the Christian principle. In the constitutional monarchy, individual dominion, a real ruler that wills, has found its end. Here, therefore, individual liberty prevails, independence of every individual dictator, of everyone who could dictate to me with a tel est notre plaisir. It is the completed Christian state life, a spiritualized life. The behavior of the commonalty is liberal through and through. Every personal invasion of another's sphere revolts the civic sense. If the citizen sees that one is dependent on the humor, the pleasure, the will of a man as individual, not as authorized by a higher power, at once he brings his liberalism to the front and shrieks about arbitrariness. In fine, the citizen asserts his freedom from what is called orders. No one has any business to give me orders. Orders carries the idea that what I am to do is another man's will, while law does not express a personal authority of another. The liberty of the commonalty is liberty or independence from the will of another person, so-called personal or individual liberty. For being personally free means being only so free that no other person can dispose of mine, or that what I may or may not do does not depend on the personal decree of another. The liberty of the press, for instance, is such a liberty of liberalism. Liberalism fighting only against the coercion of the censorship as that of personal willfulness, but otherwise showing itself extremely inclined and willing to tyrannize over the press by press laws. The civic liberals want liberty of writing for themselves, for as they are law-abiding, their writings will not bring them under the law. Only liberal matter, only lawful matter, is to be allowed to be printed. Otherwise, the press laws threaten press penalties. If one sees personal liberty assured, one does not notice at all how, if a new issue happens to arise, the most glaring unfreedom becomes dominant. For one is rid of orders, indeed, and no one has any business to give us orders. But one has become so much the more submissive to the law. One is enthralled now in due legal form. In the citizen state, there are only free people who are compelled to thousands of things, to deference, to a confession of faith, and the like. But what does that amount to? Why, it is only the state, the law, not any man, that compels them. What does the commonalty mean by inveighing against every personal order, every order not founded on the cause, on reason? It is simply fighting in the interest of the cause against the dominion of persons. But the mind's cause is the rational, good, lawful, etc. That is the good cause. The commonalty wants an impersonal ruler. Furthermore, if the principle is this, that only the cause is to rule man, to wit, the cause of morality, the cause of legality, and so on, then no personal balking of one by the other may be authorized either. As formerly, the commoner was balked of the aristocratic offices, the aristocrat of common mechanical trades, etc. Free competition must exist. Only through the thing can one balk another, as the rich man balking the impecunious man by money, a thing, not as a person. Henceforth, only one lordship, the lordship of the state, is admitted. Personally, no one is any longer lord of another. Even at birth, the children belong to the state, and to the parents only in the name of the state, which does not allow infanticide, demands their baptism, and so on. But all the state's children, furthermore, are of quite equal account in its eyes, civic or political equality, and they may see to it themselves how they get along with each other. They may compete. This book is continued on Cassette 4, Side 1.